Thank you, Jim. Thanks for and thanks, Dave, for asking me to share a little bit. I'm not a historian. I'm just another bozo on the bus, but my ego says I belong on a short bus. My sponsors think I should have a helmet on there too. But I have a love of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I'm going to do this morning is to share a little bit of the landmarks in the beginning of AA, which are covered a lot in the foreword you were just talking about. But I have some interesting things. I have a couple of video clips also that might be interesting to a lot of people. So I'm just going to get in with it. The graphic that's on the screen now, "Be Still and Know That I Am God," is one of my favorite songs, and the graphic itself comes from a retreat house that I go to out in Eastern Long Island, Sag Harbor. I've been involved in a Matt Talbot retreat movement, running a men's group there for, I guess, well over 40 years. So it's certainly also my sobriety to date is June 10th, 1977. And let's get into the presentation. This is a presentation, a quote by Carl Sandburg. It was a friend of mine who was the archivist in World Service always started with this, and he said, "When a nation goes down or a society perishes, one condition may always be found. They forgot where they came from. They lost sight of what had brought them along." And that's really my mission in AA, is to just continue to tell the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that story comes from most of the books that you see on the screen there. One of my favorite books is Language of the Heart. Language of the Heart was Bill Wilson's, all his writings in the grapevine. From the start of it in 1944, when he was just getting ready to do that in the beginning of the grapevine, he wrote just about every month in there. So several other books, and we can talk a little bit about Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob only has one book. When Dr. Bob and Bill met, of course, in 1935, we just heard that. Dr. Bob was 55 years old and Bill Wilson was 39 years old. And the relationship that they had was more of a father and son relationship. And it was really great. It was a guy who they never argued about anything. They really kept it. Dr. Bob lived at 855 Ardmore Street in Akron, Ohio. And we have a Founders Day celebration each June there. The last time I was there a number of years ago, we had over 13,000 people show up at the university there for our Founders Day. Bill Wilson lived at 182 Clinton Street, and I've been at that house a number of times over the years. I did a presentation, and there was a young girl that was there, came up to me after the meeting. She said she did the same thing. She went over to the house itself, knocked on the door. And it's owned by an Oriental couple. And she told a little bit about the story of the house, and they were glad to give her a complete tour of the whole house. Unfortunately, with me, when I knocked on the door, nobody answered. I always joked that Bill Wilson should have held on to the house. We'll talk a little bit about they lost that in April. In 19. I guess it was 2000, a little over 2010, I think it was. It went up for sale for 2,950,000 and sold for over 3 million. Today, the value of the house, the current value of the house, is up more near $7 million. So I'm sure if Bill could look back, he would be glad to had held on to it. Again, as we read a little bit there, Bill and in May 10th, actually, was tempted to drink, and he makes a telephone call to Henrietta Seiberling, the first one he called is Walter Tunks, and you can see Walter's picture there. And I'm going to have a picture at the end of this with Walter's liver. This is a good picture of Dr. Bob. They met at the townhouse on the Seiberling estate, and usually on Founders Day, they let us go through a tour of the first floor of the building. And they met and stayed there in the library room. I always thought the library room would be pretty large, but it was really just like a large closet. And that was on Mother's Day, and as we know, on May 10th when they first met, it's for both these guys. And this is a video clip of Dr. Bob's son and daughter. So.
Fateful weekend.
It was Mother's Day in 1935, a Saturday, this day before Mother's Day in 1935, and my father had come home with a potted plant, and he was potted, and he went on upstairs and went to bed. And Henrietta Sybring called and said, "Ann, I've got a man that Bob needs to talk to. Can you come right on over?" And my mother Ann said, "Well, I don't believe we could come tonight, but we'll come tomorrow." And so it was agreed that that Dr. Bob would go over there on Mother's Day.
The next day, my dad was real jittery, and he left. They left around 5 o'clock, I think, and they stayed till after midnight. And I was beginning to get worried because they said 15 minutes.
The two men hit it off at once. And instead of staying only 15 minutes, as Dr. Bob had threatened, the two men went into the living room of the Stan Hewitt Gatehouse after dinner, which was mostly left uneaten, drank gallons of coffee, and talked half the night. John Seiberling was there.
Bill and Bob, the first night they met, met in my mother's living room, and they sat there talking till about 1:30 in the morning, comparing their personal and religious experiences and how it helped them, and finally they got the idea that maybe they could help somebody else. So Bill said to Bob, "You know any drunks in town?" And Bob said, "I know them all."
To solve Bill Wilson's most immediate problem, Henrietta prevailed on a friend, John Gammeter, to provide a room for Bill at the Portage Country Club for 2 weeks. But that was hardly a permanent solution. Dr. Bob's son, whose nickname is Smitty, and who was a teenager at the time, explains that Bill became a guest in his parents' home.
After Bill and Dr. Bob met, Bill came to our house and lived for 3 months.
You know, both Bill and Dr. Bob were tall, thin Yankees. Bill was quite a bit younger than Dr. Bob. Bill was garrulous. He loved to talk to people. He met people well. He loved to be around people. Bill was a visionary and a promoter. Bill could see further up the road than any human I've ever known. Dr. Bob, although he also was a tall, thin Vermonter, was the opposite temperament. He was steady. He didn't have a lot to say. And I think these two fit together perfectly. You know, if any two of us are alike, one of us is unnecessary. So these two, who were totally different and totally opposite, never had an argument. And Dr. Bob, as I said, is a man of very few words, and when he did speak, he had thought things over pretty carefully. As a teenager, I came home one time and I said, "Dad, I got to tell you something." He said, "What?" He said, I said, "I'm in love." He thought about that a minute and he said, "No, you're not in love. You're in heat." And I got one more incident I'd love to tell you about. His lecture on sex and hygiene to me. He got me upstairs in the house here in the bathroom, closed the door, and he said, "Flies spread disease. Keep yours buttoned." When Dr. Bob Bell brought someone into the house and took him upstairs, usually in Susie's bedroom, they fed him a strong sedative called paraldehyde. Dr. Bob being the only medical man associated with this movement at this time, and they really knocked him out. They got him to take the paraldehyde by promising him a shot of whiskey afterwards, and they knocked him out from 24 to 36 hours. They really gave him a jolt.
Paraldehyde has a terrible smell to it, and the minute we would hit the house and we'd smell that smell, we knew we were headed for either the Davenport or the attic. If Smitty stayed at the fraternity house, then he was out of it. But I was in the attic or the Davenport, because we knew Dad had a victim up in my room. They just had to go up and check on these guys every once in a while because they, you know, see if they were still breathing. 36 hours is a long time for a drunk to be quiet.
After they came to, well, then Dr. Bob and Bill began to feed them a diet to get the health back. It consisted of sauerkraut. Now, Bill had an ulcer, and he thought sauerkraut cured everything. And it was sauerkraut, canned tomatoes, and Cairo syrup. I think you'll all have to agree that the early alcoholics were a hearty group.
Sue went on.
I was always thinking about getting a can of sauerkraut and try that. They could pass on it. This is a photograph of Sue. I had the opportunity in 1990 to interview Sue. I was doing some history archive stuff, and she was really interesting. And the first thing she said, this is at the International Convention in 1990, says, "Are you going to ask me why I'm here at this convention?" She wasn't a member of Al-Anon or alcohol of AA. And I said, "Well, why are you here?" She says, "I'm here to tell you people that you're forgetting about my father. There were two founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all I hear in AA stuff is Bill Wilson, Bill Wilson." She had a bit of a resentment over Bill Wilson, still carried all those years. The photograph on the right is Ernie was a real interesting character. Sue fell for the guy. Ernie was, that's one thing she asked me. She said, "Do you know who AA number four was?" And I said, "Caught me off guard." I said, "I don't know who." He said, and she started to sound like she was yelling at me. She says, "Don't you read your own AA history books?" and it was Ernie Galbraith. And she married Ernie when she was 23 years old, and Ernie was 37 years old. And she said he got drunk, AA number four, he got drunk on her wedding day. Dr. Bob and Ann Smith were dead against them getting married, and they didn't go to their wedding. So that's how much they kind of disliked Ernie. I guess because maybe he was bouncing in and out. Sue had a rough time, and here's a picture of this. I love this picture. This is after they married a couple of years and had a couple of kids, and she looks kind of youngish and beat up compared to the other picture that's on the screen. But they had two children. Let's go back to that one. They had two children between them, and they had a boy, Mickey. He was born in 1944, same year that I was, so he'd be 82 years old. And they had a daughter, Bonner, and a very, very attractive young lady, but she, like a lot of us, the family suffered from alcoholism and mental illness. And she had a daughter, Sandy. And that's a picture of Sandy. And it was a really tragic thing that happened in 1969. Again, she had a lot of mental problems, a lot of things. She had a broken marriage and was not doing well. And she decided to commit suicide. But prior to committing suicide, she murdered her 6-year-old daughter and then committed suicide. And Ernie started drinking again after that and died 2 years to the day of that terrible tragedy. So that was Dr. Bob's great granddaughter and great great granddaughter. And you know, he had been long gone. This is a book written by both of the kids, Children of the Healer, which is a really, really good, interesting book, and brings back the early times for this is Smitty. Smitty was a car buff and what have you. Sidney went into World War II. This is a I graduated from college within accounting degree. He was going to do that. Then he went into World War II as a, and he wound up to be a pilot on a B-25 Liberator bomber and served in North Africa. And when he came out of there, he wound up marrying Betty. And a short time later, Betty wound up joining us in the fellowship. And Smitty wound up going to Al-Anon. He also stayed in the oil business there. He had a plane. He would chauffeur oil executives around Texas and all the oil wells and what have you. And then he ran for mayor and became a mayor of the small town that he lived in Ocona, Florida. Real interesting guy. This is a photograph I was got a good friend of mine, Steve, gave me, and it was at the 2000 Roundup in Tampa, Florida. And on the right is Smitty, and the middle is Sue Windows, and she was kind of ill. She had emphysema, I believe. And then the woman who's standing up next to her is Mary Tunks. And again, we remembered in the beginning that Bill Wilson called the Reverend Walter Tunks, and she was there the day that the Bill had called her father. And her father had some interesting things to say. My friend Gail, who's a true archivist and a author, told me some funny stories about that, and I can't re relay them here. Smitty, Sue passed away in 2002, and Smitty died 2 years later. These are the obituaries. Just going to run through them and not read them, of both of them. And now we're going to get back to a little early history of New York. Is when let me just bring this up a little better on the screen. This is 17 William Street. And that's where most of the draft of the Big Book was written by Ruth Hock in 1938. In April 1938, the writing of the Big Book began at the business office of Hank Parkhurst and in the Anna Dealers. That's the little company that Hank had. He had been fired from Standard Oil of New Jersey, and he formed this little company to compete with the Standard Oil of New Jersey. And that was at 17 William Street. And Bill wrote the draft outlines on legal pads and dictated and expanded the text to Ruth Hock, who was the Anna Dealer's secretary. She wound up to be our first international secretary. I'm going to talk a little bit about her in a second in the drafts. So each week, Bill would read the drafts, those who met at his house, edit the copy sent to Dr. Bob at Akron for a further review and editing. And as they worked their way through the chapters in New York and Akron, members also wrote their personal stories in the book. And in the Akron, there was a photograph of the typewriter that Sue Windows was typing the stories that went into the Big Book. And a year later or so, they wound up moving to Manhattan, to Vesey Street, which is right where the World Trade Center was attacked on 9/11. And just one other thing here was, this is a plaque that was put on the building in New Jersey. A group from New Jersey AAs, a couple archivists, decided that they wanted the landlord of that particular building, and they asked if they could put a plaque up there, and that's a copy of the plaque that they put on. And a little bit about Ruth Hock. I did a nice presentation on Ruth Hock back a couple of years ago, and I really dug into her past, how she wound up coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what happened to her afterwards. Really, a great lady. But she was the one that's credited with giving AA the Serenity Prayer, which we just opened up with. And how that came about is, I always get a kick out of this one. This is the actual clip from the archives of the Serenity Prayer. Again, they had moved from New Jersey to Vesey Street in the World Trade Center, as I said. And people would AA people would naturally come up and visit the site. And a fellow by the name of Jack had a crush on Ruth. And one day he showed up with this little clipping out of a obituary from the local papers. And it's really it struck me a little bit odd. You send in a prayer from an obituary or something to impress his girlfriend. But she said in a talk that Jack was a real interesting guy. He was an Irish singer. He was the oldest in his family. And his younger brother was became famous. His name was Art Carney. A lot of people will remember him from Jackie Gleason show and stuff like that. The now the Serenity Prayer, where did it come from? Well, it was used in World War II as the soldier's prayer, and then it was used also as the nurse's prayer. But that we, as true alcoholics, claimed it as our own. And the history of it was actually written, accredited to Reinhold Niebuhr. And I just want to just read a little bit about this clip here. Ruth sent out a bulletin, and she would type all the inquiries that went out. She would sign them Ruth Hawk, and then type the Serenity Prayer on it. Then one of the members of AA decided to put the Serenity Prayer on a small card, like a business size card. And then anything that went out of the office would be the Serenity Prayer would come. Go into that the letters that went out there, but Reinhold Niebuhr was the one who that prayer was actually taken out of his writings in one of his books. But the interesting thing, years later, we move into the present headquarters, which is 475 Riverside Drive in Manhattan, overlooking the Hudson River. And the building where we're in, the nickname for the neighborhood is called the God Box because of all the different nonprofit and religious organizations and the Red Cross and a whole bunch of things like that are in there. And we moved into it in 1992. We had the 10th and 11th floor at the time. Now we only have one floor of it. So as I was when I was in leaving the building at the open house, I looked up at the street sign, and here's the street sign. I can get it up there. It's West 120th Street, but it's renamed Reinhold Niebuhr Place. So our headquarters right now is sitting on the corner of Reinhold Niebuhr Place at the AA headquarters. I thought that was one of the spiritual things when I saw the sign up there. But it wasn't named after the Serenity Prayer at all. It was Reinhold Niebuhr was a professor at the University, Theological University, which is a block or so or two away from our God Box building, our headquarters. So I always found that to be interesting. The building itself was, again, Rockefeller came back into the picture, that not directly with us, but he was the one who owned the property there, and it was built there. Here's a picture of Dwight D. Eisenhower, a former president, putting in the cornerstone of that building. And in our big book, it talks about the cornerstone. Cornerstone being believing, the foundation being willingness, and the keystone being that God is our director. So you always got a kick out of that. And I talk a little bit about the big book covers, which is always interesting. These are the two, they asked a guy named Ray Campbell who was an artist in Manhattan who was sober. And the story is in the first edition of the book, I'll get to in a second, to come up with covers for the big book. And it went back and forth between these two, and actually it came out to the circus cover on the left there, and as we know it today. And the other one on the thing had the text in it, the pathway to a cure. And some historians think that's the reason that they didn't do use it. And Ray's story is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the other interesting little facto on it. His story, again, the book was printed, came out in April in 1839. Okay. So this is the first story. He says, what's in the beginning? It has the Herbert Spencer Crook. It's the principle, which is the bar against all information that we notice in the appendix number two in the back of the book. And at that time, there was no appendix in the book. So when they came out to do the second edition of the book, and the first edition went through 16 printings. So that was in those 16 printings of the first edition. 1955, they decided to not change the basic text, but add and delete stories. And one of the things that they did is they changed the numbering. They moved the doctor's opinion from page number one to the forwards of the book. And they took Ray Campbell's story out, but they took his Herbert Spencer quote, and then two printings later in 1957, they put this into appendix number two in the back of the book. Real little fact stuff that I enjoy reading, and so that's Ray Campbell. The other thing we're going to talk about too is Morgan R. And again, this is the early part. How am I doing with time? I'm talking too much. More, they put Morgan up there. They sent out 20,000 postcards to doctors. They figured they would get a huge response from it. They held Morgan in a hotel so he wouldn't drink. He was fairly new. And it was a real short talk. It's really interesting. And then they went to the post office and they wanted to see how many inquiries out there should be found. And now this is Ruth Ox talk. So Morgan agreed to appear anonymously and did a great job with the 3 minutes, not too long. But we all listened breathlessly at the radio. As I remember it, his talk, it was slanted at doctors and back to him. We had mailed out thousands of postcards to a selected list of doctors. They spent $500 on it to reach them in time to get them to listen to the broadcast and tell them how to get a copy of the book. We had an assembly line all ready to pack and mail the books when the orders came rolling in, and then we waited. I didn't think more than four cards were returned at all, and the only one that made my impression was one of the first ones that came in order for 6 books, COD. So here it is. They're going to get bulk orders. So this is, they're all excited. There was great jubilation that morning. Naturally, we thought we were in. We simmered down to as close to gloom as I ever remember, and got in the next few days over the few replies, and were most of them were doctors that Bill Wilson talks about were drunk. You couldn't make out what they were. Were really squashed flat when a package of the 6 books that they sent out marked no such address. I'm afraid none of us appreciated for a while the humor of whoever the joker was. You always get a kick out of that one. And again, the book was 4,730 copies were printed, the first edition, and they come out. Whether I have time to, I only got about 10 more minutes. This is I'm just gonna play a partial clip of this. This is High Watch Farms. You can see Abby Thatcher, Bill's sponsor, and that was Bill's car. On the left-hand side, Marty's w was one of the first women to get sober. And I'm just going to play this clip, and I think we're going to be out of time by the time it ends. It's a clip of Marty Mann talking at the anniversary of Stepping Stones, not High Wycombe Farms.
High Wycombe Farm has always meant a great deal to me. It's given me a lot more than I've ever given it. And I haven't been nearly as close to it in recent years as I would wish. Many of you have heard my story, and I'm not going into all of it, but suffice it to say that at the end of 5 years of hell on earth, I had finally found a doctor who was willing to take me under his wing. I'd been completely honest about my drinking with all the doctors. This was in 1937, and I never once heard the word alcoholism mentioned by anybody. I didn't know the word myself. I knew I drank too much. And Dr. Tebow came into New York once a week to interview people who were thinking of coming to Blythewood and whose families wanted to put someone in Blythewood. Dr. Tebow came into New York. He had been reading this manuscript, and he thought maybe this was something that would help me. And he handed it to me, and the title of it was Alcoholics Anonymous. Many of you have heard me tell of what happened to me with that book. It has a relation to the farm and to its meaning for me and for many others. When I started reading the book, I was thrilled to death because here for the first time I found out what was wrong and that this was a program to deal with the obsession of the mind that drove you to drink against your own will very often when you didn't want to. At last, I could understand why it was that I couldn't go back to drinking the way I used to. Something had changed and I would never be able to take alcohol normally. And I accepted it. Dr. Tebow wanted me to remain on at Blythewood. And so I stayed almost 6 months. And finally, in mid-September, I was due to go. This was 1939. I had attended my first meeting on April 13th. 2 days before I left, the ambulance had screamed up and a stretcher had been carried out. And there was a girl in a straitjacket on the stretcher. It was Nona Wyman. And she had been brought back. Nona, of course, was an alcoholic. She was terribly drunk. She was suicidal. It wasn't possible, really, to talk to her. Of course, I had the book with me. And I started reading it out loud to her. She was receptive. She was willing to listen. She and her husband both drank too much, but they had a friend who had suggested some 3 or 4 years before that they go up to a place in Connecticut where this friend thought they might find some help. And they had started going up to this farm near Kent, which was run by a very strange little old lady who called herself Sister Frances. She said, "You know, I believe that this AA that you're telling me about is exactly what she's trying to do. I think she'd be very excited about this." The interesting thing was that I never wanted a drink while I was up there. I never drank while I was at the farm. But I wouldn't be home very long before I'd start again. She said, "It does something strange to you. I don't know what it is. It's wonderful." A few weeks later, the two of them succeeded in getting some of us to agree to go up and see this remarkable place. It was a beautiful weekend in October, and we drove up. There was Bill and Lois and Horace Crystal and Bert Taylor and myself with the Wymans. All of you know what it's like as you come over the hill or come up to the top of the hill, and suddenly there's that adorable little house with just a smallish barn across from it in those days. We stepped over the threshold, and Bill turned to me, and he said, "My God," he said, "you could cut it with a knife." And I said, "Yes, you could." The atmosphere, the feeling. There was something there, something that was really palpable, that you could feel. And every one of us felt it. That was one of the most wonderful weekends I have ever spent. We talked far into the night with this extraordinary woman called Sister Frances, who was a very lovely person. And the reason she called herself Sister Frances was because St. Francis of Assisi was her favorite saint. Her real name was Ethelred Folsom. I'm not surprised she took Francis. And what is at the farm was already at the farm before we ever found it. It found us, in my opinion. The story of that farm, as I had it from Sister Frances, is pretty fascinating. She set out looking for a place, and apparently she searched for a long while. Until one day she found this, it's really a cup in the hills. And this was the place for people who were in trouble of any kind, whether it was physical trouble or mental trouble or spiritual trouble, material trouble. they could try to find themselves, and if they did, they would go away refreshed and able once again to cope with life. The farm was known all over the world, and people came there. But the thing that really happened to Sister Frances when she met A.A. was that she fell in love with A.A. We all made use of the little chapel. We all went in there for our quiet time. And before the end of the weekend, she'd offered it to us, lock, stock, and barrel. She said, take it. She said, we're incorporated as a nonprofit corporation, the Ministry of the High Watch. That's where that name came from. And we began making use of the farm. And when I say making use of it, what I mean is that we would take somebody up there for a week or 2 weeks, usually stay with them. I went up there so frequently, I was working like a beaver to get some women into AA. There isn't any question that there was something healing just about being there. I know what the farm means to someone who needs it, because I needed it, and I found there what I needed. Little by little, people became more interested in it, particularly as people came away from there and stayed sober. Little by little, it was transformed into truly an AA place. I know of no one who was happier at the way that gift was being used than Sister Frances herself. I have visited a great many places that have indeed sprung up in its image, but I have never been anywhere in the world that has the thing I'm talking about that exists at the farm. There is something in the air. God has his finger on it. Thank God.
I've had the good fortune to speak up at High Watch Farms. Myself and my sponsor were asked to speak at one of their anniversaries up there back in, I think it was the late 1980s. And it's really kind of a special place that Bill Wilson and early AAs were involved in it, that they would go up there. I know I'm getting close to the time. I just want to hit a few things. This is the Rockefeller dinner. It's a copy up the on the right hand side of the actual invitation, and I have the envelope that Dr. Silkworth had addressed to him for that dinner, which certainly set us on our feet. This is a Foster Kennedy, who was instrumental in getting Marty Mann sober. He was working in Bellevue Hospital at the time, and kept her in the ward where she was only supposed to stay, rotate out, and, you know, in 28 or 30 days, and he kept her there for a number of months until she got into, as a charity case, and got into Blythewood Seminary. I got a tough time talking this morning. Must be my uppers. Anyway, Dr. Forster Kennedy spoke at the Rockefeller dinner. Appendix number two, which we don't really talk about very much, is the medical view on AA. And he addressed the Medical Society of New York. And again, this organization of Alcoholics Anonymous calls on two of the greatest powers known to man. Religion, we call it spirituality, and that instinct for association with one's fellows, the herd instinct. And boy, how true that is. We have to stay part of the herd. And that's the gift of meetings all over the world. You know, there's about 2.5 million of us sober, and we're all part of the same herd. And what happens to a lot of us sometimes is we stop going to meetings, or we leave the herd. And that's when alcoholism becomes, you know, the drink comes next and what have you. And this is the envelope I was talking about that was sent to Dr. Silkworth. And I had a whole thing on him too, about the Rockefeller dinner. And I think I'm just going to talk about the 24th Street Clubhouse, and then I'm going to finish up. This is the clubhouse. I really got a kick out of this too. And it's the first clubhouse. It was rented at the address in New York City for $100 a month. It was formerly the Illustrators Club. Bill W. and Lois moved into the small upstairs bedroom. this is a drawing of the bedroom. Now, this is the honeymoon suite. I always joked about doing it. Again, they lost the house at the end of April of 1939, right after the book was published. And they moved from couch to couch. Different people would put them up for short periods of time. And then when they opened the clubhouse, upstairs there's this small bedroom. And you could see how depicted how small it was. You probably lay in a bed and you can put both hands out and they would hit each walls on it. But they stayed there until they wound up in Stepping Stone. This is a little history of the New York Intergroup. New York Intergroup's office started out of the 24th Street Clubhouse. And this is about Liberty Magazine with Fulton Osler. Now, Fulton Osler took Liberty Magazine, I was the editor of Liberty Magazine, and he published the first article, AA and God, in there. Other magazines had turned it down. They didn't want any interest in it. And I always wondered why. And then into the research a little bit, his family member, his wife, was an active alcoholic at the time. And the real interesting thing is that his wife, because of his association with AA, with the magazine, got sober. And then the magazine was sold, and he eventually went over to, in 1944, 45, to become the editor of A Reader's Digest. But he wrote a couple of books, Father Fonnegan's Boy, but the main story was The Greatest Story Ever Told, was his main book. And I think I'm going to end the thing there because it's just about only a few more minutes left, so that's how I'm going to do it. I'd like to thank the group for asking me to come and to share a little bit. Just stop the screen share. I think I stopped it. And that's my little present. That's it. That's the short part of it. No, I did that presentation on a couple of sites, AA sites, and it's geared for an hour and a half presentation. So I took what I could on it. There's another long, long list of everything. So I didn't want to sneak you through that. So, Jim, thank you very much for letting me share a little bit of history. If anybody has any questions on it or anything, I'd be glad to answer them. Thank you.